Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cheese and Pickle. Hello, this is Comfort Blanket and I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to someone who makes cool stuff that I like about some warm stuff that they like. A book or a TV show or a film or a record that they go back to again and again for comfort. This time I'm talking to the comedian Michael Spicer. Michael's probably best known for creating The Room Next Door sketches, a series of films in which he plays an exasperated advisor talking down an earpiece to a series of idiot politicians. Michael's a good comedy brain. He produced Mandy, the Diane Morgan series, and as a good comedy brain, he's a big fan of Monty Python. We were talking about this, and I said, "What do you go to for comfort in Monty Python?" And he went a bit quiet and said, "Series 4. And I said, "Me too." And we both knew that Series 4 is the series you're not meant to like. So, obviously, I had to get him on.
We are here today to witness the opening of a new box to replace the box which used to stand on the corner of Ulverston Road and Sandwood Crescent. Owing to a programme of road widening being carried out by the Borough Council, the Ulverston Road box was removed, leaving the wall box in Esher Road as the only box for the people of the Ulverston Road area.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
There you go. It sounds like you're about to sit down and be questioned on Mastermind. I know this is your specialised subject.
Yes, it is.
I know it's a very stressful thing to be quizzed on.
Yeah.
And obviously we both know this inside out, so this is going to be extremely high pressure.
Yes, indeed.
But what you've chosen is one of the most popular things in comedy, its least popular iteration.
Yes.
What a sweet spot to find.
Yes.
Next week on the Golden Age of Ballooning, we examine the work of Glaisher and Coxwell, the English balloonists who ascended to a height of 7 miles in 1862 without washing. There is also a book called The Golden Age of Ballooning, published by the BBC to coincide with the series. It's in an attractive hand-tooled binding, is priced £5, and failure to buy it will make you liable to a £50 fine or 3 months in prison.
Growing up, there were these repeats. BBC repeated Monty Python series 2 and 3, I think, in 87, so I was about 10.
Yeah, the perfect time to pick it up.
Just absorbed it. But it wasn't something I felt I could really share with any of my... I had one friend I could share it with, and no one else really took to it. I think that's mainly because it was, for some reason, they put it on after Match of the Day. It was really late on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
But my mum and dad didn't really care too much about bedtime on a Saturday.
In 40 minutes, we've something which really was completely different in 1969 and yet still maintains its bizarre appeal today. It's Monty Python's Flying Circus.
So I watched it all. And then I remember Channel 4 showing Meaning of Life, because there seemed to be some sort of general reappraising, because obviously it was 1989 was coming up, so
it's heading up to 20th anniversary.
BBC Two will be taking us back to the beginning of Monty Python's high flying career.
There was a vibe about sort of reappraising it, which now feels like insane. It was only 20 years old.
20 years. So yeah, I was working that out in terms of where we are now and how
you
should never ever do that.
Peter Perfidi calls that mortality maths.
Yeah,
and you must never do
maths,
it.
Exactly. I'm terrible at maths, and I'm very good at just blocking that out. So.
This is Mr. Death.
So when Meaning of Life was broadcast, I remember, because it was an 18 and was a lot more adult, the children at school then got some glee out of... Did you see?
Ah, good afternoon, sir, and how are we today?
Better.
Better?
Better get a bucket, I'm going to throw up.
Gaston, a bucket for monsieur.
Meaning of Life is kind of designed for playground gossip consumption. Do you see that bloke who exploded? Do you see there were women running with their boobs out?
Yeah.
I can wear whatever I want on my John Thomas.
It's designed for a boys' playground.
It is, it is. And even though I was like 12, I was still going, yeah, well, I like the earlier repeats.
We're going to find out that basically what this is about is just saying, I'm a terrible wanker.
This is where I'm going with this chart, is that I... really love Series 4 because it's just such a mess and it's so different. And I like the fact that the Pythons like it. And nobody else does. Nobody else even watched it, it would seem.
I have to say, to my embarrassment, I don't think I ever saw all six of them.
I remember that being a very, very big deal for me as a kid getting into Monty Python. I'd heard about it. I'd seen a couple of episodes. I think when I was a little kid, my dad had said, stay up late and watch this. Or if it was a sick day or a bank holiday, you'd stay up late and watch it. I'd seen about two episodes. I got obsessed by them. I'd seen them once and learned them. I don't know how. I'd make little tapes of myself as a kid going, The Larch, over and over again. Not knowing what it meant. It was like you'd been exposed to like a religious a liturgy that you'd learned. A meaningless liturgy.
The Larch.
Then they said, I think it was on the run-up to the 20th anniversary, around then, they repeated seasons 2 and 3, which I think are regarded by culture as the good series. The two series which have got all the sketches you know in. They didn't do season 1 while it's finding its feet, and they didn't show series 4, which everyone agreed should be buried under the M3 and never spoken of again. So I think there was that feeling of going, I've seen the ones everyone else has seen, but there's some secret Python.
Morning, squadron leader!
What-ho, Squiffy!
How was it?
Top hole! Belly Jerry, Prentice Kite, right in the house your father. Hairy Blighter, Dicky Birded, feathered back on his Sammy, took a waspy, flipped over on his Betty Harpers and caught his can in the Bertie.
Fair, didn't quite follow you, squadron leader.
It's perfectly ordinary banter, Squiffy.
There's no iconic sketches in there, I don't think. There's a certain type of person who loves Life of Brian and appreciates their humour, but they won't actually sit down and watch an episode because they might go insane.
He can't eat, honey. It makes him go plop plops.
Oh, come on. Please try some.
Oh, I'd have some Icelandic honey.
No, there is no such thing.
You mean you don't make any honey at all?
No, no, we must import it all, every bally drop. We are a gloomy people. It's so crikey cold and dark up there and there's only fish to eat. Fish and imported honey, oh, struth.
We should probably explain what happened with Series 4 and why Series 4 is different. Because it's not, the previous series are called Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yes.
This is called Monty Python.
This is called Monty Python.
Because the BBC said you need to make sure that people know it's not the same.
Yeah.
And all the other series are 13 episodes and this one is 1974 and it is six episodes.
Six episodes. And they did this virtually after finishing Holy Grail, I think.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. You'd think they'd want some time off.
If you read the diaries, they're happening exactly the same
time. Are they
happening
at the same time?
They're editing, they're showing screenings of Holy Grail while they're getting this together. Right. And it's a mess. And the reason they do it is John Cleese has wanted to leave Monty Python for ages. He says they've done everything they could possibly do. And he finally goes, I'm not doing this new series. I walk out. So you're left with five guys left. They do one series. They did six episodes with the possibility they might do seven more.
Seven more. And then Eric Idle apparently said no. In an interview, I remember he said that there was a tension between Terry and John that wasn't there. And so therefore they didn't produce their best work. Now, it's so bizarre to think about it because I think another seven episodes probably would have been incredible. But it's so interesting thinking about John Cleese saying, well, we didn't do anything new in Series 3.
I felt after the second series that we were beginning to repeat ourselves, and I didn't see any point in doing comedy or doing anything very artistic and creative if you were beginning to sort of repeat yourself, and it was the old sausage machine, you know, another 13 shows, just keep turning. The others just love the process. They really enjoyed doing it, and I don't think they felt that we were repeating. They didn't notice the difference in the material. material, but it was clear to me.
He says the only two sketches are Dennis Moore in the cheese shop that are any good or original.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how... Do you identify? Can you relate to that?
Have you watched it? Maybe he hasn't watched Series 3 of Monty Python. It's really good. John Cleese should watch Series 3 of Monty Python. It's great.
My heart sank as I realised that I should never see the Oakhampton bypass again.
Come on, dear. Wake up, dear.
Mother, so it was all a dream.
No, dear. This is the dream. You're still in the cell.
He's like someone who goes and finds base camp and then won't build anything there. Series 3 is a beautiful city built on terra incognita. They found this new place. In Series 2, they get it right. Mm. And in Series 3, they build these enormous mad castles on this new territory they've got. Mm. And Cleese is going, no, I'm going to wander off and find something new. And you go, yeah, but look at the amazing stuff your mates are building on this place. Yeah. And I think that's the difference between him and Terry Jones. They're different sorts of restlessness.
Yeah, I think also perhaps there's more of a kind of surreal element to it. You feel like the surrealness is coming from Palin and Jones.
Yeah.
And the extraordinary wordplay is coming from Eric Idle, and there's a lot of anger and argumentative
There's
sketches.
A rigour thing. There's an Oxford-Cambridge divide that runs down the middle of Python.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really weird to understand when people try and analyse how Python works, which obviously you and I will do off mic for the rest of the day, but there's an Oxford-Cambridge divide, and Palin and Jones are Oxford, and Idle, Cleese and Chapman are Cambridge, and Terry Gilliam is Occidental, so he joins the Oxford side.
Yeah.
So it's Ox versus Cambridge. So there's a little divide down the middle of it, and that divide gives you your central double act within Python, which for me is Terry Jones and John Cleese, which is a classic double act. There's a tall officer class one and a slightly more working class, lower middle class one who's full of energy.
Mm.
And it's the same dynamic as Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Mm.
And it's the one that's in Bedazzled. It's that thing they play brilliantly in Bedazzled. I think it happens a lot in comedy. Those two energies go really well together.
The funny thing is, I made a note of how sometimes it felt like some characters could have been played by Peter Cook. There's there's a bit from the Michael Ellis department store episode where Graham Chapman is sitting at a complaints desk and he's on fire. But he's saying, would you like a fire extinguisher? Oh, no, better let it take its course.
Yeah.
It seems that's a very Peter Cook. And also, I mean, this is Graham Chapman as well, but when he's talking about as Icelandic honeybees, trying to sell Icelandic honey.
I love that sketch.
And he says, of course there is an Icelandic honey.
Listen, cowboy, I got a job to do. It's a stupid, pointless job, but at least it keeps me away from Iceland, all right?
Again, it feels like that could have been Peter Cook doing a monologue to
Dudley
Moore.
There are fragments. Cleese left, but left behind some writing. I mean, he's a writer on
this.
Yes,
he is a writer.
The Michael Ellis episode, the one that's all set in a department store, which is a great way of stringing together loads and loads of shop sketches.
Yes.
And it's occurred to me this time around.
Yeah.
Python loves a shop sketch. All your shop sketch can happen in a department store. It's a brilliant excuse for a linked episode.
Yeah.
But that episode is lots and lots of stuff that was left over from the Holy Grail writing sessions. The first draft, and it's all set in Harrods. And they look for the Holy Grail in Harrods.
In Harrods, I remember that,
So there's lots of Cleese left over. So he gives them a load of material, and you can really feel that Michael Ellis episode has got loads of Cleese irritated people in shops sketches. There's lots of that, the toupee sketch.
Yeah.
Like, nice, solid, old-fashioned, proper Python sketch writing.
Someone told you we all had toupees?
No.
Oh, yeah.
How did you know? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
What do you mean obvious? His is undetectable.
Well, it's a different colour for a start. It doesn't fit in with the rest of its hair. It sort of sticks up in the middle.
Well, it's better than yours.
Yes. I'm not wearing one.
When people look at Python, they keep looking at the writing partnerships as double acts. But actually, the Python double act is between Oxford and Cambridge.
Mm.
And when it splits up, you can feel it in Series 4.
Yeah.
The whimsy takes over.
The whimsy takes over, but it feels almost like it's written by modern artists. It feels like you could show that at the Tate. There's like layers and layers and layers of stuff. It's like they've gone, this isn't it though. I'm going to add another little bit in a kind of Spike Milligan way, I guess.
Yeah.
Adding an extra layer and an extra layer until you don't know where you are. I mean, there are times it's just so sort of Catherine Wheel of different ideas.
And Mr. Bartlett.
Oh dear, I
first time I watched the series for a long time, I was really surprised how much I enjoyed watching it again. Not surprised, delighted by how much I enjoyed watching it again. And I, the first time I'd watched it without watching any previous Python. I'd not watched any Python shows for ages. If the previous three series hadn't existed, this would be regarded very, very, very highly.
I think so, yeah.
Because this is the one that's more like Q.
Yeah.
Everyone always says, including Milligan, that the problem with Python is it's a rip-off of Spike Milligan. And the truth is that Python isn't a rip-off of Spike Milligan. Season four is, because that's the one where the whimsy, the Oxbridge whimsy, and the absolute love of Milligan's freewheelingness, which Palin and Jones completely represent, is allowed free reign. Cleese is a massive Goon Show fan, but I always said Cleese was far more of a Marty Feldman and Barry Took fan. He likes precision. He likes that craftsmanship. He's a big Feldman fan. He's far more round the horny, really, in that kind of way. The person who phoned the others bubbling with excitement that he'd found it, he'd cracked it when he saw Q, was Terry Jones, who wanted to borrow that anything goes feeling.
Yeah.
You want to see the Q, the Milligan series of Python? It's season four.
Jelly molds.
I am so obsessed with them that when people say, oh, it's hit and miss, I just can't, I can't see that. I can never see that. I can't see which. There was an interview with John Cleese on the Omnibus 20th anniversary documentary in which he said, well, I saw some of the repeats and I think there's probably one or two sketches that are good in every episode, but there's so much dross. And I remember thinking, John Cleese, you are incorrect.
Yeah.
I know you're a Python. You are incorrect about this. People love it.
Hello, madam.
Oh, hello. You must have come about
finishing the sentences, yes?
Oh, well, perhaps you'd like to
come through this way, certainly.
There's a misunderstanding, I think. There's a lovely quote from Eric Idle. He said, it's really hard to take compliments about Python, which just shows how competitive they were. These are Oxbridge people. They're very competitive. He said, it's very hard to take compliments because you only did a fifth or a sixth of it. And so people keep complimenting you on the 5/6 of it that isn't you. And I went, that tells me loads about you, Eric Idle, as a collaborative person. But there's a feeling, I think, because they are competitive, that they will look at it and they'll go, which are the good sketches? And is it your ones? To the public and to Python fans, there's a real feeling this is a lovely collaboration between these six amazing minds that will never happen again. And you only want to watch them just do this. I love the individual stuff, but I want to watch them do this. But to them, it was a showcase for what they could do. There's a fight within Python sometimes between individual expression, showing off your dazzling chops, the soloists, the guys who can shred on the comic guitar, and the band that's probably being run mainly by Palin and Jones, who really like the band.
And every Thursday night, there's bloody cabaret in the bar, featuring some tiny emaciated dago with 9-inch hips, and some fat bloated tarts with their hair brill cream down and a big arse presenting flamenco for foreigners.
This palette is no more. It has ceased to be. It's expired and gone to see its maker. This is a late palette.
And I think that for the public, they're a band, and for them, sometimes they're individuals. And that fighting that gave them their energy and that spark, for them is very, very real. And for us outside, I just want to watch them all together. And that's why I think I love watching the whole episodes, because I want to watch all those flavours. I don't want to pick my two favourite. I like the chocolate box. I don't want that thing that Quality Street do where it's all the purple ones. Where's the fun in that?
There were still things we wanted to write. There's still performances we wanted to do. There was still a great deal of energy in the group. But I don't think Python ever really works without everybody there.
Well, I mean, you will probably disagree with me about this, but I have never been a fan, not because I don't really appreciate what they were doing, because I know they're extremely talented, but I've never been a huge fan of Rutland Weekend Television and Ripping Yarns and other projects that, you know, Yellowbeard. I don't like Yellowbeard very much.
That's going to lose us a lot of listeners. Please don't text in. Please don't text in. Don't send a postcard in. All the Yellowbeard massive are coming for us now.
I know. I'm really sorry. I know, Yellowbearders, you're very antagonistic when you want to be.
Mr. Prostitute, who is responsible for... Nail that man's foot to the deck.
What's vitally important is I'm watching all this when I'm 10. Yeah. All I can see are grown-ups being funny and silly. Yeah. And I don't really care about the... The weird thing is when you're getting older, You have to find out all the things you don't want to find out about them not really getting on and falling out and, you know.
Should pretend they were all best friends?
I wrote an annual. I actually did an annual called Monty Python's New Flies. Oh, my God. Why am I admitting this?
But you're saying that as if that's a weird thing to do. But you look at what happened when we were growing up and they were repackaging Python for the first time for a new audience, which they did. The way they did that for us is they got Steve Martin to pretend he was the seventh Python and do a documentary. And then a few years later, they got Eddie Izzard to do it.
Yes.
I think it's completely normal. All comedians want to be secretly another Python. They want these guys back together again. They're their heroes. You want the Beatles to reform.
Wasted, Mr. Lennon, you're wasted.
I love Fawlty Towers. I'd like to be in that, you know.
Would you?
I'd love to be in the Monty Python.
Yes.
You know, rather than the Beatles.
That's the thing
in a
that
way.
Saved us.
The magic of Python is the hit and miss. People forget this about sketch comedy. They keep insisting, like culture secretaries, that we only have hits, forgetting that the fun of an exploratory art form is it explores. If you get to the end of Python and choose your Monty Python's best bits, like they keep compiling, they'll be good sketches. They'll be technically good sketches, but it's not Monty Python. Python has to miss as much as it hits, and you have to disagree about what your favourite bits are, like reading a comic.
Yeah.
It all has to be in there because it's not about the individual sketches. It is about a feeling of being lost in this world where anything can happen. And one of the things that can happen is a sketch can go wrong.
Well, now it's time for racing, so let's go straight over to Epsom and Brian McNulty.
Well, over here at Epsom, there are chances of plenty for those who want to make a good start in,
Dentistry.
It's a well-off suburb, so most people have their own teeth. And surgeries are opening at the rate of 4 or 5 a week.
In every episode, there was always some sort of theme.
Yeah.
And that always gave it its own identity.
Yes, you don't want to break that.
No, and it felt like if you took a sketch out of that episode, it wouldn't work as a best of bit. It's like it's like the flow won't work. It's like one of my favourite episodes is in episode one where the theme was funerals. It was like there was so many sketches about undertakers and burying coffins and things. And half the time the audience is totally baffled. They just don't know what's going on. And it kind of adds to the darkness of the episode.
Yes.
And of course it's 70s and it's so dingy and everything's so grey.
Well, here in High Street, Epsom, there are ample opportunities for all kinds of redevelopment.
That world, the world includes not only those guys and what they're dressed like and watching it as a period piece as a kid, that every time they went out onto the High Street, the vans and the what the roadworks look like and the fronts of the shops and that redolence of it. I wanted to live in West London in 1972 because it looked like a magical place.
Yes.
It was as vivid a fantasy space as Tatooine was for me. I wanted to go there. I want to go there to that dirty place with all those horrible men. I want to go there and I want to be there when everyone's on strike and there are all these names like Reginald Maudlin and Paul Fox. It's a fantasy world because it's you forget it was real and it was contemporary. By the time we got to see it, it was old and it was like the same thrill you get watching The Monkees or something. It was set in the past.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I totally agree. And the weird thing is, of course, is that they occasionally went to, in order to do something that needed a beach or sunshine, they'd go to Paignton when it was really rainy and cloudy and horrible.
There was no sunlight in Britain until 1995, I think.
Didn't appear to be. No, if you're watching Monty Python, it's like even when they were trying to create some sort of coolness, they just never seemed cool. It never worked for some
reason. The
whole
of Britain on 16 mil is overcast.
Yeah,
it's a really specific feeling.
Alex Diamond, international crime fighter and playboy. Fast moving, tough talking, and just one of the many hundreds of famous people who suffer from lumbago.
It gives it a lovely texture, and I think and you lose yourself in it. But I think the thing about immersing yourself in the whole thing, there's a revisionism about Python, which is that lots of it now, if we're honest about it, isn't that good. And when you look back on it, we got a bit overexcited about it, and it's not that great. And no one really watches it anymore. And I think the lovely thing about doing this week and you suggesting to do this is you're the first person who said to me in ages, do you know what? It's all really good. And the reason it's all really good is because those bits you take out don't work without the rest of it.
Yeah.
In fact, they do. I mean, they might technically be a good sketch. That's what John Cleese is saying when he says that there are two or three good sketches.
Yeah.
They're technically well written, but they're not as good unless they're buffered up against some stuff that is meandering and silly. They need to be set in context. And the context is a bunch of very clever, very funny performers exploring. And if they've found the results and have just given you their results, that's nowhere near as interesting as watching them go and find those results.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's why, in order to watch it now, you have to watch it in a way that you watch other old comedies. You have to tune in for a bit in the way that you have to watch Duck Soup or Way Out West.
Yeah.
As in, yeah, it's still just as funny, but tune in a bit. It's like, I don't know, the first couple of minutes of a musical. Mm. You've got to go, they're going to burst into song in a minute. This is done in a different way than we do it now. It won't all be hits.
Yeah.
Some of it will be meandering. Some of it will be set in places you don't recognise.
Mm.
You'll have to tune into it. And then once you do that, it's the combination of all the moods and all the flavours that makes Monty Python. It isn't the best bits. It's not the films. No. It's this.
No.
I tried that. I once got down to 56 stone, boy. I couldn't stay like it. I had to take potatoes wherever I went.
But don't you find it amazing that as a 10-year-old or, you know, 12, I mean, there are things I'm not understanding here. But for some reason, it is still all making complete sense. I will lap all of this up.
Last year, some of us from Yellow River, we got on a party to go and see the ballet in Montreal.
Look, I was wondering...
Oh, we had a marvellous time. It was Margot Fonteyn dancing Les Sylphides. Oh, it was beautiful.
Look, do you know...
Do you know how old she is?
Who?
Margot Fonteyn.
No.
She's 206.
Oh. As a kid, I didn't understand anything in the grown-up world. The television was 99% things that weren't for me, whether it was Kojak or Nationwide or the news. It was full of things I didn't understand. Python didn't sound any different than the rest of television. I was used to, as a kid, watching things where I got 50% of the references.
Well, everyone is talking today about the Third World War, which broke out this morning. But here on Nationwide, we're going to get away from that for a bit and look instead at the latest theory that sitting down regularly in a comfortable chair can rest your legs.
And I think watching it as an adult now, you go, oh, this would fly over the heads of kids. No, no, kids are very, very forgiving because kids are used to not understanding things.
Yeah.
The world is confusing and weird and baffling and cartoonish to kids. And Monty Python said, yeah, it is to us as well, as grown-ups.
Yeah.
It wasn't a barrier to me that I didn't know what they were talking about.
No. A lot of the time it was a springboard for learning about things. Mm. Like the Freemasons. I had no clue what the Freemasons were, but there was this sketch that said that they shook hands in a very strange way and
rolled their trousers up.
Yeah, and rolled their trousers up.
I think most people's knowledge of Freemasonry comes from that sketch.
I think so too.
Yeah, they were sort of a peep round the corner of a door to adulthood. Certainly as a kid, I remember thinking, I'll learn this. It isn't for me. But I really, really want it.
Yeah.
Which one is von Bülow? And Admiral Tirpitz?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And von Müller and Reichner?
Oh, yeah.
And Holweg?
Oh, really?
And von Gromberg?
Das ist Gromberg? Das ist Gromberg?
Yeah. And Zimmermann?
Yeah.
And Klimt?
Oh, Klimt, yeah. What should we do, Helmut?
We must ring the government.
This is the government.
One of the keys to how Python works is it's full of abstract language that is specific to an elite group, an in-group, historians, philosophers, things like that, that's presented to you just for the rhythm of its sound.
Mm.
And then by learning it, because you don't know what it means, you then have access to that. And I love that they would teach you philosophers' names and the names of sports teams. And
yes.
Things. You pick it up. And so because of that, you learn it. Like you learn dinosaur names as a kid.
Yes.
I got obsessed by learning all the knowledge that Python had in it.
Yeah.
And that meant I ate all of it up. And I think that's why, as a much older person, season 4 is magic.
Yes.
Because I know the rest of it. I've learned the rest of this. And this is new. The stuff I haven't learned off by heart yet.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. It's odd, really. It's like it feels like Michael Palin's almost like in the sort of Paul McCartney role in this one, because he's just everywhere. And it seems like he's got his fingerprint all over it, him and Terry Jones.
Yeah. This is theirs, I think.
It seems like theirs. It feels like every historical sketch is written by them, and there's a lot of it. I took history at school, and I probably learned more from Monty Python sketches.
Yeah.
There were little potted histories of famous people that I'd never heard of before.
They get the information right, because it's funny.
They get the information right. It's just the way, the fact that the first scene of the first episode is Michael Palin under a sink talking about the Montgolfier brothers.
The golden age of ballooning can be said to begin in 1783, when the Montgolfier brothers made their first ascent in a fire balloon.
And it's all accurate.
Yeah.
He's not saying anything funny. Occasionally he'll go, come on, come on.
On the eve of their momentous ascent, the brothers took one last look at their craft as it stood on a field of Annoncé.
The fag hanging out of his mouth.
There's a running joke. The best place to see it is Holy Grail, where there is a running joke that drives a lot of, certainly Palin and Jones's sketches, which is about obsession. And also how funny it is if the wrong people have a university level education in something.
Yes.
Listen, in order to maintain airspeed velocity, a swallow needs to beat its wings 43 times every second, right? Please!
Which I think is quite a generous thing, because universal education for the working classes was new in the 60s. So there's a novelty that plumbers and screechy old ladies know everything about philosophy or,
yeah,
or Louis XIV.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune.
This idea that people have a very arcane knowledge and they'll dump all this stuff. And I'm always stunned thinking, this is before Wikipedia. This would have been a big book off the bookshelf,
yeah,
to write. I love that.
I do think, I think we're 1 minute into a sketch and already there's just so much, the years and the place names and everything.
I've been looking it up in my bath. Louis the 14th died in 1717.
Different languages sometimes, and I'm just thinking, wow, yeah, they would have had to, they must have gone to the British Library or something.
Nuisance ici ce matin, de quoi de moi. Qui ont placé la boîte, qui autrefois était placé au coin de Ulverston Road, à Sandwood Crescent.
You forget this is a revolution that's only just started happening about maybe 10 years earlier. We're sort of beyond the fringe and things.
Mm.
Comedy has stopped being a working class profession, has become a middle class profession. And it happens with the rise of the professional comedy writer associated with London Scripts, Bob Monkhouse having gone to Dulwich School. Your writers are coming from better backgrounds. Mm. They used to be northern working class comics who'd go and do the halls. You've suddenly got university comedy, and its tone is to wear its erudition very heavily.
Monsieur Necker, the man who introduced so many valuable reforms and proved so popular despite his opposition to Mirabeau's policy of issuing assignats.
And it's a little flag that waves to go, hey, education's got more accessible recently. Did you learn some stuff at school as well?
Oh, fair Ophelia, nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered.
So anyway, you've got the girl on the bed and her legs are on the mantel.
If you are part of this new generation, you've got access to polytechnics and exams, and the university grant system only comes in for ordinary people in the mid-60s. This is a brand new thing where this wouldn't be seen as elitist as much as it would be seen as a joyful expression of a new comic voice.
Well, I've certainly never heard of Basingstoke in Westphalia.
It's a municipal borough, sir, 27 miles north-northeast of Southampton.
What? Southampton in Westphalia?
Yes, sir. Bricks, clothing, and nearby the remains of Basing House burned down by Cromwell's cavalry.
Who compiled this map?
Cole Porter, sir.
I think you're right. There's genuine joy in it. I mean, these people are in their 20s at the beginning, in their mid-20s, and they are just firing off ideas. You can sense the energy, the desire to get so much crammed into half an hour. For me, the following Sunday, after I'd watched it, I would then start writing and drawing and recording and doing everything that I'd just seen. It inspired me to produce similar, surreal work.
What's strange is it's incredibly clever and wordy and dense, but it's also incredibly achievable because it just says, what do you know? Mm. Dump all that onto a page. It's a club of saying, do you learn something? Share it. Maybe there's a funny take on this. And all jokes are jokes about shared experiences. When they were writing for the Frost Report or something, they'd say, well, write something about the shared experience of going to a garage.
Oh, your gearly was loose, isn't it? That's where your trouble is.
I can't get into third half of the time.
Well, you must expect teething troubles in these new models. Best gearbox made.
But there's no knowledge from outside basic observation. Mm. If they'd said we're doing this about parrots.
Remarkable bird, the Norwegian blue, isn't it? Beautiful plumage.
It's full of euphemisms for death. Mm. The script editors or the producer would say, why are you doing this? Mm. But removing that valve that's saying it has to be relatable and saying about anything you want, you can then insert a load of arcane knowledge about historical treaties or ballooning into the same shape sketch. Mm. By not being limited by observation, they get the best of both worlds. They get this thing where these are genuinely sketches about what it's like to argue with a stubborn person.
Yeah.
I mean, they are experimental. They're fun in the same way as Radiohead or Captain Beefheart are fun, because it's not just the same three chords you've heard before.
Yeah.
They're finding new tunes.
Gone.
What's gone, dear?
Nothing. No, just like the word. It gives me confidence. Gone.
gone. It's got a sort of woody quality about it. Gone. Gone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ferdinand von Zeppelin was born in Konstanz in 1838, the brother of Barry Zeppelin, the least talented of the 14 Zeppelin brothers.
There is some really broad slapstick visual humour, like Barry Zeppelin inflating rather than his balloon.
What a great joke.
That's a great joke. It reminded me of the seaside sketch from the first series of Terry Jones trying to find a place to change.
Yeah, the silent movie stuff.
I was watching that and I was thinking, are they parodying this or is this coming from a genuine place?
They like, love that stuff.
They do love it. And it's weird that...
The Silly Walks video.
Yeah.
The film, you really like Silly Walks, watch this. The fish slapping dance. They like a good wordless bit of slapstick. Queen Victoria handicap. Loads and loads of Queen Victoria's running in a straight
now. Moved up to challenge Queen Victoria with Queen Victoria losing ground and Queen Victoria tucked in neatly on the sand side with a clear view. Queen Victoria still the back marker as they...
One of my favourite things is, I am an idiot. Look, Terry Jones...
Doing all of those things.
When Terry Jones nails his own hand. That's a stunt as good as Raiders. He gets dragged behind a truck for quite a lot. There are sparks coming off his feet. Very, very Milligan. It just shows a love of Q and that sort of slightly old-fashioned slapstick. It's fine.
His director was also Monty Python's director, Ian McNaughton. He does get overlooked a lot, given that he was involved so much in their progress and their development and also directed And Now for Something Completely Different.
I don't know how he did this.
No.
I was watching this going, apparently they were sort of saying he'd kind of lost a bit of interest. They're all heavy drinkers and it was a bit of a mess by this point. There's a lot of heavy boozing going on. Everyone talks about Chapman, but everyone is drinking too much. It has got a real sort of saloon bar, smoky vibe to it. Apparently the lovely sketch on Westminster Bridge where Palin's a policeman, he's absolutely pissed in that. He's basically, they've been drinking all day, a lot of wine. You can't tell he's great.
You can't park here, you know. What's that in? Right. I'm taking that in for a forensic examination.
But that is one take a lot of the time.
It's astonishing.
It's one take on Westminster Bridge. He crosses the road. He stops real traffic. It's incredible.
Danny, the Chaldeans, who used to inhabit the area in between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, their helmets was of the modular restrained kind of type.
And also, now that Cleese is out, Michael Palin is virtually everywhere. Yeah. I mean, they're in the department store, he's outside, he's in the lift, and then he's in the person that you're meeting.
Palin is now accepted as everyone's favourite Python, and yet everyone's not meant to enjoy the series he's in most.
No, that
this is your Palin series.
Yeah.
The whole of Golden Age of Ballooning is just he wrote that on his own. He's trying out where he's going to go with ripping yarns.
Yes.
He's trying out his voice, and it's some beautiful performances.
Yes.
Now, sir, I wish to protest in the strongest possible terms. Yours sincerely, Brigadier N.F. Marwood, Git, brackets retired. Read that back, will you, Brian?
And when he had built up Cedron, he set horsemen there, and an host of footmen to the end that issuing out, they might make outroads upon the ways of Judea, as the king commanded them.
Good. Pop it in an envelope and bung it off.
Even though Idle is probably right that losing that engine, losing that fire in the middle of it between the Cleese faction and the Jones faction, loses some of its rigour. It is really nice just to see the whimsical people take over for a bit. Even though Python is something that happens when all six of them get together and it's that combination, and that is lacking, it's not like this version of it isn't what you tune in to Monty Python for. Mm. And weirdly, I think if you're tuning in for Monty Python only waiting for the rigorous logic, there are definitely some other comedies I can recommend.
Yeah.
Father, what are you doing?
I'm making a boot.
What?
It's a cutty sock. It's a model I've been making in the dark for some years now.
Well, wouldn't it be better with the light on?
No, no, I'm making it in the dark. That's the point. Oh, dear. It's not as accurate as I thought.
It's not a cutty sock.
Well, it hasn't got its sails on yet. Oh, well. I'll have a look at it in the dark room in the morning.
You suggested doing this because both you and I admitted to each other that if we sit down of an evening to watch a Monty Python,
yeah,
I'll tend to pick one from series four.
Right.
Mine's Light Entertainment War, which I will watch when drunk and did for years. That was the standard one I approached. The shocker about the series is that it's really, really good.
Yeah, it is. I don't know why it's like the way it is, because you know that John Cleese is involved in it, but obviously he's not involved enough. But it still retains enough Python from previous.
Yeah.
So I just love, and I can't explain why, but there's always a moment throughout the four series. I always want to say seasons now.
I've been
indoctrinated to say season.
The Americans keep stealing Python off us. Let's claim it back.
Series of television where they're at a loss. They're at a loose end on TV.
Yeah.
And they're like, when's the next sketch? They're just standing there. They're just waiting for something. And at the end of Golden Age of Ballooning, for some reason, Chapman's butler is just praised and gets curtain calls. And Eric Idle and Carol Cleveland are just there like, why is this?
Thank you, Atul.
Not at all, sir. I've enjoyed being in it.
Right.
Thank you, sir. Manziel?
And it reminded me of The Young Ones Postman, when everybody's waiting for this postman to do his two lines and then get out. And they're just, the idol standing about on a set is absolutely hilarious.
Here is your package!
Well, thank you!
Was I all right?
It's about the lack of rigour. What Cleese leaves and takes with him is the rigour. He's about to go off and do rigorous farce with 40 Towers.
Yes.
He's a person who wants rigour. The whole point of Python was to not have that rigour, to escape from the restrictions of people who knew how it was done and the script editors on the Frost Report. The fact that it's got a minute for people to just stand around and wait for a curtain call to happen or for something to go wrong, that's why you're watching it.
Yeah.
Again, if you do the best of Monty Python and snip out that fat, snip that loose stuff out, that's the good stuff.
Yeah.
One of the jokes with Python is that it's very hard for things to get started.
Yeah.
Because people get distracted.
Yes.
They start info dumping stuff about French kings on you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always an adventure that can't get started. You can't run away in Life of Brian because someone wants to haggle about the price of a beard.
Yes.
The idea is that the exciting adventure you're on gets knocked badly by someone becoming obsessed.
Yeah.
Everyone's making excuses for why they can't get the story started. And season four is full of, even though they say, we'll do some narrative now, and you won't.
The
joke is that it will keep getting...
Well, I mean, there's a great bit where he goes, there's an actual thing about Louis XIV getting... stealing the plans for the golden. That's an actual plot point.
Yeah, it's a good sitcom. It can be a Blackadder. It's great.
Yeah, it's really good. And then it goes back to Carol Cleveland and Eric Idle, and he says, I've got the plans. I gave them some fake plans. And you think, that's a great twist. And then straight after that, she says, what do you mean? And he says, let me put my tongue in your mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all he wants to do is snog her from there. And then it doesn't go anywhere else after that. And that is so beautifully frustrating.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. Is I think that previously Python had said, even if we pretend we're about to do an exciting adventure on the high seas, it would start and then someone would get distracted by talking about Wolverhampton Wanderers or something. It would get distracted and you'd go, it's okay, it's only a sketch.
Mm.
What Palin and Joseph said is, why don't we do some stuff where there's some story?
Yeah,
but you put story into Python where the core joke is this manic changing of subjects and inability to focus.
Yeah.
You're going to frustrate people because you promised them that Mr. Neutron would be a superhero story.
I know.
And it isn't.
And it isn't at all.
Could he be stopped in time?
Got a bit of work to do there, then.
Yes, it is a problem.
Mrs. Ottershaw never used to bother. Then, of course, she was very old. She was 206. Must be going. If you need a hand, I'll send Frank round. He could do with a bit of exercise. That old bastard.
He just doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything for half an hour. And every time they go back to him, he's engaged in some terrible small talk with a pepper pot, and he's actually genuinely interested, but he says it in his neutron voice, like,
it is good for the shops.
Good for the...
There is something I have to tell you.
Yes, Mr. N?
I have just won a Kellogg's cornflake competition.
Because the whole point of Python is you can't get things started. It's frustrating to watch. Mm. And you can see them struggling with that at the same time as they're just breaking into doing Holy Grail and finding out what David Quantick calls the Oxbridge plot, which is all your sketches strung along someone else's story. And they really struggled with that with Holy Grail and Life of Brian, to make sure the sketches went somewhere.
Mm.
And what you see in season four is that if you do try and do that thing that Palin and Jones want to do, which is tell a story, the fact that you're only interested in breaking the rules of narrative fucks your story.
Yeah.
And anyone watching it going, I was hoping it would have the narrative consistency of the goodies. And
yes.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's probably where the goodies will always triumph, won't they? Because
the stories actually work.
Yeah, because the stories work. But because of this desire to confuse and just be generally surreal, there's no room for it. So inevitably, Chapman's butler comes in, halts everything, and the credits go.
Yeah.
Not at all, sir. I've enjoyed being in it.
If nothing else, to its own detriment, this series is endlessly surprising.
Yeah.
Watching this again, I was fascinated by that. I went, this is the best demonstration I've ever seen of the two competing drives of surprising jokes and solid narrative, and why they fight against each other, why it's so rare to get an airplane.
Yeah.
Or a Holy Grail, something that's got some sort of narrative, but also anything goes.
Or a very, I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but I think Channel 4 really should have commissioned a full series of The Weekenders with Vic and Bob.
Yes.
Because that is...
Yeah. That's the closest
that's
thing.
That's a narrative with surreal things happening. It's the closest thing you've got. I mean, that is art.
Jim, what the handbag carnival Partridge Underfelt's going on here? Bob, it's like this. These three gentlemen here are aliens, and they need my specialty meat product to feed their queen so she may pupate and thus ensure the survival of their race. So I've given it to them in exchange for them being my slaves for half an hour.
I want every joke you can do. I want top secret, Mad Magazine style things where... As long as something followed the logic of a joke, it would be the next beat of a story.
Yes.
And yet somehow strung along a story.
Yeah.
They're really rare, because I think they're really hard to do.
Yeah.
And they are regarded, when you read critics, they go, oh, do you know what's the best film out of Roxanne or The Jerk? And the answer is, it's The Jerk.
Yeah.
Because that's harder to do than Roxanne. And I like both those films.
Yeah.
But Steve Martin managed to make a stand-up routine into a story about someone I cared about. That is a miracle.
Yeah, a miracle.
And the Python... Season 4, if you're a comedy nerd, is a perfect demonstration of those two impulses.
Yeah.
Grinding against each other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, Joseph, all you think about is balloons. All you talk about is balloons. Your beautiful house is full of bits and pieces of balloons. Your books are all about balloons. Every time you sing a song, it is in some way obliquely connected with balloons. Everything you eat has to have the word balloon incorporated in the title. Your dogs are all called Balloono. You tie balloons to your ankles in the evening.
I don't do that.
Well, no, you don't do that. But you do duck down and shout, hey, balloons, when there are none about. Oh, your whole life is becoming obsessively balloonic, you know?
Having mentioned Carol Cleveland, there's something I did notice rewatching this, is that she's got stuff to do now.
Yes.
It's lovely.
She's got
lines, she's got jokes, she's got characters. When you consider her first sketch for Monty Python was just not saying anything and just being ogled by Eric Idle.
Yes, this looks a sort of thing. May I just try it?
Certainly, madam.
Oh, sorry. So sorry. Yes, that's fine.
Is that on account, madam?
Yes.
But it was lovely to see Carol Cleveland do that because, you know, all this talk about the seventh member. Creatively, obviously, she probably had no input at all. No. But she's great.
This is a very good series for seventh members. Both seventh Pythons,
yep.
Neil Innes and Carol Cleveland, get a lovely, lovely chance to do things.
Yes,
and
yes.
They get a chance to contribute and be funny. There's more room for them. And I think this is pointing towards, there was a debate, I think, briefly, if this is in Palin's diaries, about saying, should we officially offer a seventh Python role?
Oh, right.
Is there a way of maybe pulling in Neil and making Neil Innes the sixth Python so we can have him in more sketches and pay him properly and things? Mm. They were talking, obviously, they never offer that money to Carol Cleveland because she's just doing typing and washing up. but there was a feeling of saying, should we open it up? If we're losing John, should we bring someone else in? Mm. And it's got a generosity that gives it a few different textures. Like there's some lovely stuff from Neil Innes. The music is better.
Yes.
There's a chance for wistfulness, like Innes' little song by the Spitfire.
When does a dream begin? Does it start with a good night kiss? Is it conceived or simply achieved? When does a dream begin? When does a dream begin?
It's gorgeous, that. And also, I think it feels a little bit, just from his animations, that Terry Gilliam is sort of checking out a little bit. Because by doing that, because the thing is, with John Cleese gone, Terry Gilliam didn't step up, did he? He stays in these kind of peripheral roles.
He does his grotesques.
But his animations don't seem quite as inventive. There's fewer of them. They don't join sketches together as well as they used to. So therefore, you've got this strange opening for Innes and others to come in and share the spotlight a bit.
And you get contributions from outside. So there's a sketch by Douglas Adams, co-wrote with Graham Chapman. Because the thing is, one of the reasons that Cleese leaves is that, as he said quite rightly, he was shackled to an alcoholic.
Graham now had a really serious drinking habit, and I was the guy who met with him every day. You see, the others didn't. The others just saw him when we got together to read, but I was carrying him, and at one stage he couldn't remember in the afternoon what we'd written in the morning. I mean, it was that bad.
Everyone in the team went, who's going to work with Graham today? Yeah. And the answer is no one wants to work with Graham.
Yeah.
So Graham ends up writing with some outsiders, so he writes himself with Douglas Adams.
Oh, yes, you must be Mr. Williams. Well, do take a seat. What seems to be the trouble?
I've just been stabbed by your nurse.
Well, I'd probably better have a look at you then. Look, could you fill in this form first?
And he writes, I think, probably my favourite sketch of the whole series with Neil Innes. Most awful family in Britain is a Chapman and Innes sketch.
Mm.
If you're talking about, is there a classic Python sketch in season four? It's that.
Yeah.
There now follows a party political broadcast on behalf of the Liberal Party.
Pratt, back to Pratt. Pratt again, a long ball out to Pratt. And now Pratt is on the ball, a neat little flick back inside to Pratt, who takes it nicely and sends it through on the far side to Pratt. Pratt with him, but Pratt calls him apart.
I've run out of beans.
I really like this ain't a week, but really unclogged me.
Oh, do be careful.
Sorry, Mum.
I mean, a lot of the other side here unclogged me, but I never had a single bowel movement with them rectopus.
Now, if we... Oh, sorry, Mum. If we lived in Rhodesia, there'd be someone to mop that up for you.
That is how bleeding stupid. If you lived in bleeding Rhodesia, you'd be out of bleeding fascist rallies every bleeding day. You're a bleeding racist, you bleeding are.
Language!
Well, he gets on my sodding wick.
It's four or five character gags running in parallel.
They're not talking to each other.
So it's just, you
They're
follow
not talking
anybody.
To each
and it's
other.
There's something so funny about that. It's arranged like a very complicated song.
Yeah.
Wilkinson's number 8 laxative show. What? That went through you like a bloody Ferrari.
And it's a horrible family who are classified as lower middle, their social class. And you go, oh, it's a bit sneery.
Mm.
Oh, you're trying to get a bit... I watched it with my woke glasses on and went, oh, university-educated middle-class people having a go at the working classes. Yeah. And then you realise that the second awful family who have beaten them.
Well, with the scores all in from the judges, the Garibaldis are number 3 and a surprise at number 2, the Fanshawe Chumleys of Berkshire.
And the thing, which I didn't realise, I looked up that year, this is 1974, November, December 1974. Earlier that year, The Family had been aired on TV, the first ever fly on the wall reality show about a lower middle class family.
The problem was to find a family prepared to tolerate the intrusion by a film crew into their every private moment. We carried out many interviews, and finally, one family emerged that we hope can meet the demands of this documentary serial, the Wilkins of Reading.
And this appears to be the absolute horror of Britain seeing itself on screen.
It's so odd, though, that sketch, because in reality, it's still set in Monty Python's surreal world, in which Graham Chapman's weird teenage daughter with the beehive is actually a member of Parliament.
I'm off!
What time are you coming back tonight?
3 a.m.
I think it's disgusting. You a member of Parliament.
Every single Monty Python joke has the potential to fracture the reality of the sketch in a way that most sketch writing doesn't. Mm. You could say something next that would break it. And the joy of Python is you've agreed, the contract is, you enter it and you go, this is Monty Python land, where that woman, that weird beehive lipsticked 11-foot tall monster can be a member of Parliament, and it doesn't break the sketch.
No, it doesn't.
I accept that the mum can be ironing the telephone and hanging up the flattened cat.
Yeah.
The fact that there's a man in the cupboard who's someone else's dad.
Yeah.
Dad?
Yeah?
No, my dad.
Oh.
Dad?
All that stuff, which belongs completely to N.F. Simpson, Absurdist Theatre.
Absolutely, yeah.
Don't say you're ready, Sylvia, at last.
Ready? With my arms like this? Whatever you may say about apes, at least they don't have to bend down practically to the floor before they can reach their knees.
Arms like apes, if you please. That's what you want now.
Couldn't run through it, Sylvia. Need a whole new set of glands.
You're bringing something from Absurdist Theatre onto TV, and you're right, this feels like the closest Python gets to its roots in absurdism, in surrealism.
Yeah.
Same with that other craze. And she wanted to be a pterodactyl.
Without needing John Cleese's rigorous... if you say she's a member of the Parliament, it kind of spoils the point.
Yeah.
Is she or isn't she a member of Parliament?
And has Faye Dunaway definitely said yes?
It's a suspended reality where she's both.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Shut up!
Yes, Mum!
When Terry Jones died, I tweeted probably my most favourite line of Terry Jones, which is from season two, and he's doing a vox pop about his daughter, who's gone to become a lobbyist. And he says,
well, she's broken our hearts, the little bastard. She's been nothing but trouble. And if she comes on here again, I'll kick her teeth in.
Like that, just with proper passion. And then he goes into the house, and Michael Palin's there usually stuffing a chicken as he normally is. And she says,
have you been talking to television again, dear?
Yes, I bloody told him.
What about?
And he goes,
oh, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. All the passion's gone, and his actual reason for being has gone.
Oh,
it's just disappeared. I love it.
Hi, Mrs. Robinson. Morning, Mrs. Non-Robinson. Been shopping?
No.
I've been shopping. What did you buy?
A piston engine.
What did you buy that for? It was a bargain.
Be rubbish.
The reason why this feels different to me is I still relate it back to the first time I bought it.
Right.
Because Monty Python 1-3 was given a big trumpeted fanfare in the evening, and I would prepare for it, you know, get the video recorder ready, prepare
put on your,
for it.
Your correct uniform.
The major's uniform. and more often than not, I would be watching it with my family. But this was different because what I did was, and it's so weird to remember these things, but I grew up in Barking in Chadwell Heath, and I used to go to Romford HMV to get my VHSs. And just browsing, you know, as normal, series 4, 2 tapes, series 4. I was like, what? Why didn't anybody say anything?
Wow.
Nothing. And it was obviously distributed by some, I don't know who, Virgin, I've no idea. Somebody who just said, is that not on VHS? Of the BBC not? Oh, okay, well, we'll just knock it out. And of course, they're very bad covers and, you know, been put together, not by Python or Gilliam. And taking them home and watching them on a Wednesday afternoon, you know, knowing that no one else had
probably
different
watched. Vibe.
Different vibe. So even just watching it recently, it still had that Wednesday afternoon, nobody else knows about this vibe.
It does feel like that. There is a sort of forbidden thing because, as the remarketing of Python goes on and the new view is that you just want the best of. You just want the cream of it. And then maybe the films. We've grown up now as a culture enough that we can say just the wheat and no chaff.
Mm.
We'll just pick the best of this. We've got this band called the Beatles, but they've got a blue album and a red album. And the rest of it is pretty disposable.
Mm.
That is what happens with these things where they become culturally iconic, is that you will discover them as a next generation in the way that the Britpop guys found Revolver. It's a brilliant thing that David Quantick said about Revolver is none of it's on the Red and Blue albums.
Oh,
it's the record where none of that stuff's on the greatest hits of the Beatles. So a generation discovers it and that gives you Oasis. You create a huge excitement about a very familiar thing by finding the album that slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
This feels like the deep cuts.
It does, yeah.
And
yeah.
Ownership is so important for fandom.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, if someone told me there was another Beatle record,
yeah,
it would be my favourite Beatle record in the way that lots of Beatles fans suddenly went mad recently for Beatles for Sale.
Right.
The record that they said was the shit one.
Right.
It's great. It's great. No, why is it great? Because I don't know it off by heart.
Yeah,
I've not sucked all the juice out of this one. For something which has been so over-marketed in a kind of Spamalot compilation of the best of spammy parrots stuff.
Yeah.
This hasn't been sucked dry. It's still got some juice in it.
Oh, Gervais, do sing me a song.
Oh, okay.
Something woody.
For she's going to marry him!
Oh, crikey. Old song's finished her off.
Do you know what it's called? It's called Monty Python.
Yeah.
Like the Beatles' secret record you discover in Zander. It's called The Beatles.
The Beatles, yes.
And he goes, has it got any hits on it? No, the White Album's got no hits on it. What? Oh, my God. This is probably the best one.
Yeah, this will be the best, definitely.
This is Monty Python's White Album, isn't
it?
It's the one that, it's the one that hasn't got anything on the greatest hits.
Exactly. So stumbling across it in a Romford HMV, it's almost like they were doing it for me. Like that sketch where they try to confuse a cat by putting the theatre in the garden.
Yeah.
It's like they did that for me.
Well, I think I can definitely say that your cat badly needs to be confused.
What?
Shh. What? Confused. To shake it out of its state of complacency.
Yeah, and also, because this is just for you, there's a sense of going, well, it doesn't make much sense, this one, so maybe this is the one that's just for me.
Yeah.
It does feel private, this one.
Yeah.
And now, back to me. Hello. And now it's time to go over to Hugh Delaney at Paignton.
Hello and welcome to Paignton, because it's from Paignton that we take you straight back to the studio.
Hello. And it's from here we go over there.
Well, we're already here, so let's go over there.
Welcome back.
I love a good climactic ending. I love the young one's bus.
Mm.
I love Vic Reeves being shot at the end of Vic Reeves' Big Night. I don't just want things to end. I want them to
have
really nice big production values. And this and this absolute mess of a series ends like it was going to carry on. We just stop.
And now it's time for part 8 of our series about the life and work of Ursula Hitler, the Surrey housewife who revolutionised British beekeeping in the 1930s.
They go into a sketch and then they abandon it. Then they go back to it. then they insert something else. And for some reason, you can hear a tuba. And then it just cuts. There's no reason for it. It is the high point of their messiness.
Yeah.
And then Michael Palin says,
that was a party political broadcast on behalf of the Liberal Party.
And then just breaks into laughter.
It ends with laughter.
Ends with laughter and it fades out. And it feels so right, so correct. But watching it on that VHS, coming to an end and rewinding, I thought, oh my God, it felt like a loss, proper loss. It's like, oh, there's nothing else
now. We've run out.
I've run out. I've got all the books. I've got all the albums. I've watched the films. That's it now. That's Graham Chapman's dead.
Graham Chapman, co-author of the Parrot Sketch, is no more. He has ceased to be. The rest of life, he rests in peace.
He died, was it one day before the 20th anniversary?
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
The 20th anniversary of Monty Python didn't really mean very much to me. It seemed too conventional, too neat, not nearly arbitrary enough for Monty Python. But Graham's death changed all that. Suddenly I found myself wanting to look back and celebrate all the things that we did together.
You know, I can still remember, you know, getting ready for school and it being on the BBC News.
Yeah.
Devastating. And and once that episode had finished, that was it. There was nothing, there's definitely not going to be anything new. That 1999 BBC Two Python night with Eddie Izzard, that never sat well with me. They were dressed as Gumbies and it wasn't quite right. It's almost like, you know, it's traditional. It's the tradition. It's the pythonic Which it must never,
it's
ever be.
It's got to be a mess.
Yeah, it's got to be a mess.
Right, and on with the pixie hats! And order in the skating vicar! And anything goes in, anything goes out. Fish, bananas, old pajamas, mutton, beef and trout.
It's great that it ends with the title saying that was a party political broadcast on behalf of the Liberal Party, because that is the joke with Monty Python. Monty Python, you forget this as well. You forget what it must have looked like when it came out. I was looking at the titles for these. One's called The Gold Major Ballooning. One's called Hamlet. In the Radio Times, these listings will say Hamlet or part of the broadcast on behalf of the Liberal Party. The idea about Python is supposed to break into your regular viewing, disrupt it by pretending to be other things. One of the things we didn't get growing up watching this is that when it went out, people really did interview each other on blue psych sets in two metal framed chairs.
Hmm.
Normal television looked like this.
Yeah.
This was indistinguishable. This was as convincing as those brilliant Harry Enfield or Victoria Wood mock docs. Or, this had the same crew and budget as real television had. It didn't look like sketches. It was meant to interrupt television, disrupt it, skewer all its cliches. And I love the way it ends with claiming to be something it isn't.
That was a party political broadcast.
And them cracking up, because the whole joke from the beginning, it's not a flying circus.
Yes.
It's not a circus.
No.
It's not owned by someone called Monty Python, some showbiz agent.
Yeah.
Everything about this is saying you've tuned in to watch something and it will trip you up and it'll be unexpected. And maybe that sense of sadness at the end is going, oh, don't stop.
Yeah.
Carry on.
I remember an interview with Ben Elton in the Omnibus documentary, which was he can remember not wanting the show to end. And sometimes they would have the BBC Globe at the end and then say, and now it's time for something else. And you'd realise you're still watching Monty Python and the next thing is just another sketch.
George Harrison said it was one of the few things that made the world make sense. The fact they disrupted it and put nonsense in.
Yeah.
The rest of television and the claims that these people, the politicians and the experts and the authors and the filmmakers, were serious. That was the problem. It was that inside the asylum, outside the asylum idea that Douglas Adams had. Going, the idea is this is supposed to be a little madhouse, but actually, by saying everyone's mad, they're the only sane people. And then by framing it and having the framing very blurred, that the titles would, it would go the end at the beginning. But they do a thing where suddenly it goes Thames at the beginning. And you forget it would have sat seamlessly within the run of everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't look like 16 mil, overcast, weird Python
No,
land.
No.
It was actually part of your television viewing.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's the sadness at the end of it, is they go, we've finished now. We've done all that. We're not going to provide this service for you. We're not going to do this. I felt that. I thought, I wish, maybe the day-to-day was the closest it was for me growing up. Will someone do the same job for the television for my generation and make me never be able to watch it seriously again? You want to feel that someone's pointing out the sensible people are mad.
Well, I don't suppose there's much we can do, really.
Not on television, no.
The one thing you don't want to happen when you've been given that opportunity is for it to stop. And I think maybe that's what you're talking about here with your finding the VHSs.
Yes.
You thought it had stopped.
Yeah.
And then someone said, do you know what? There's more.
That was my holy grail, Joel. It was in HMV in Romford.
not Harrods, after all.
No, not Harrods. And it was interesting, actually, because that HMV was almost like in some sort of Victorian house, and I had to go upstairs. Records were on. It was, converted. So it was all, the records were on the first floor, and the VHSs were in some sort of weird bedroom.
So it's almost like they've hidden it away, and you're going into like an attic and you're finding a thing that no one else knew was there. It belongs entirely to you. It's a treasure you have to dig up. And of course, when you dig it up, it's the forbidden. Serious. It's the one.
It's that one.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for bringing in the forbidden, non-existent Monty Python series. Monty Python.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
That was a party political broadcast on behalf of the Liberal Party.
Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris for the Cheese.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week.
Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media, and don't forget to like and subscribe.